We're gonna get started. Everyone should hopefully have sheet. If you don't, here it is. Yeah, this is what we're going to. This is Christoph. Well, this is, you'll see, I just decided not to recopy a lot, and I added some stuff to the original source sheet for us. So the top is just the end of the piece passage that we saw from Rav Soloveitchik about his relationship, about his wife and all that. So we're gonna leave that aside, but we are gonna use sources 14, 15, and 16 for today, and those go to the other side of the sheet. Okay, so just to frame, this is going to be the last class in which we're going to address the question of human's place in the universe. And today, we're going to pick up a little bit on some of the strands we were discussing, but really try to move to at least some different approaches to resolution. And to, in particular with regard to the relationship between between humans and the animal kingdom, in particular, using that as a way into the larger conversation about the really, how do we ultimately resolve this question? We said that for the majority of certainly Western history, the general assumption was that really we're dominant and that there's really a very clear-cut hierarchy, and then we had all the questions that were raised by scientific findings and so on and so forth. And so the question is sort of what we do and how can we move on from here. And so what I'd like to share is three, not maybe full resolutions, but three approaches with some interesting sources as well that can perhaps help us to find different ways to resolve this tension and to hold them both together. What we did see is Rav Soloveitchik and the Rav. We'll circle back to him later on this evening, but the Rav basically pointing out that there's this dichotomy, that there are two aspects to humanity. There's the lonely man of faith, there's the Adam 1 and the Adam 2, there's the Adam who rules over his environment, there's the Adam who is very much in a more symbiotic kind of experiential relationship with his environment. There's majestic man, there's origin-minded man, these different dichotomies in terms of how we relate and how we interact. And so the Rav is saying that there's a bit of truth to both of these sides. We're dust of the earth, and yet we're almost quasi-celestial beings. So that clearly frames the issue that there are there's a tension, but the question is there some sort of resolution to this tension at some point? So what I'd like to share is sort of, again, three approaches, if not full solutions, but I think interesting perspectives that give us a little bit of a way, a new and fresh way of thinking about these issues. So the first one is based on an article written by not Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, but his brother's grandson. Is there a name for that relation?
Yes, his great-nephew.
Well, his great-nephew, I guess, would be right. That's correct. You are absolutely right.
So I know, because it's Rav Aaron's grandson, and he spoke here like three times.
So Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik has been here in this Beit Midrash before my time, and I think he spoke in the community.
He spoke in the shul several times as part of the Kalkinu project. Way before your time.
That was, but I've heard of such things. So can't say I have fond memories, but Jude and I go way back. So way, way back. His parents live around the corner from my parents in Tina, so we grew up together. So Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, the younger son of the Rav, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who spells his name differently. They spell it without a T, that's how you know. The different sides, that doesn't imply anything other than a different spelling. I guess the way to differentiate. He's trying to find his own identity. You can psychoanalyze it, but I don't think this actually was happening.
You know that joke about, he was once at the, if the beginning sounds familiar, people just stop. He was once at the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, he gave the...
He gave the
benediction.
At the most recent one, yeah.
Right. So somebody came over to him.
Yes, I know. Tell everyone else.
Right. And said,
very funny.
It's
hysterical.
It's nice that you're the mayor, but what city is Soloveitchik?
What city are you...
what city are you representing, right? Are you mayor of?
Right. He said it was the only time that people were more impressed by his first name than by his last name. Okay. So anyhow, so he has a really interesting article. He has some really interesting articles, and this is an article about Kashrut. It's published in Azure, which is a now defunct journal coming from Israel, and it's a thoughtful piece. And he analyzes. He presents four different theories as to the basis of the symbolism of Kashrut, and he goes through different suggestions. And the one that he prefers, and that this article is putting forth, is that the distinction that we make between kosher and non-kosher animals, between behemat tehora and behemat tmeia, is essentially symbolic of our distinguishing Jews from the Gentiles. By eating the different, or by distinguishing among the animals, in a representative fashion, we say that the animals stand, they symbolize humanity. We are designated symbolically as the behemat tehora, Gentiles. You'll forgive me, but this is essentially what the theory would then recommend, is that the Gentile is designated as the behemah tmeia. Okay, so
not to leave this room.
What? That's basically the thrust of it. I mean, he doesn't, you know, you can use a nicer language that says in Parsha Noach, more euphemistically, behemah she'inena tehora. You can say that, but I mean, that would be the thrust of his article, which is, it's not what I want to focus on now. But that's his working theory, and what he does then is he has an interesting detour, which to me is not the primary thesis of the article, but for our purposes it actually is highly relevant, and it speaks to our discussion. He takes a step back and he says, hold on, let's just think this through for a moment. What we're suggesting is that the animals are used as representative of humanity. We could have used all sorts of different symbols. We could have used, right? We could have earth and the heavens. We could use vegetation, all sorts of different plant life, and so on and so forth. There are all sorts of different, right? We could have, spoken about, splitting, one-cell organisms, right? And meiosis and mitosis and all of those things. There are all sorts of different things we could use to symbolize or to designate this distinction, but we don't. We use the animal kingdom in particular. And so he asks an interesting question. He says, why specifically animals? Why do we use animals to symbolize or represent humanity? And the point that he wants to extract, and I think if his theory about kashrut is correct, which is a big if, but if it is correct, then I think this would be something like this would be forthcoming, likely, which is that it's probably not a coincidence that it's specifically animals that we use to represent human beings, which might seem to imply some sort of, not equality, but kinship, or sort of closer relationship in a certain way between humanity and animals, as opposed to other kinds of beings, which is actually a very traditional Jewish idea, which is that we find the notion that there are, for example, four levels of existence, right? There are humans, right, who are the medaber, and then there's the chai, the rest of, right, the animal kingdom, and then you have tsomeach, vegetation, then you have domain, minerals, rocks, and so on and so forth. So this four-part distinction between, right, that has humanity at the top and then the animal world just below, right? And the notion that there's a particular kinship, their relationship, is one that's familiar. But he wants to go further, and he sort of develops what I call, just one second then, he develops what I sort of call the man's best friend theory of man's place in the universe, which is basically what he's saying is that humans are clearly above the animal kingdom, but there's a certain kind of either kinship or a certain kind of sort of framework in which we see the animals an extension of the human master, a sort of in the wider context or an environment of humanity. So it's a way of retaining the distinction, the sharp distinction, between the human on the one level and then the animal clearly below, but what it says is we sort of occupy the same domain. Animals are used to symbolize us, and they're going to be used in other really interesting ways to reflect on the human master, or to otherwise act in ways that imply that the animal is somehow an extension of, or in the orbit, occupies the orbit of the human being. That's sort of the idea.
So So when you say animal, you're talking about all other living beings, like does insects fall into that category?
Good question. I don't know. He doesn't directly he doesn't directly address that, and it could be that some of the animals that have certain more physical commonalities with the human being might. Although it's interesting to think about this when we think about, right, do you go by mammal? I mean, if you think in modern scientific terms, I wouldn't think that the ox is more similar to the human than, let's say, the dolphin, right? That's an interesting kind of problem to think about. So it's a good question, and you'll see in the examples that, yes, it may have limitations. It may not be all animals. I don't know for sure, but I think that's arguable. I will just say that on the Kashrut theory side of things, that that does apply, obviously, to all sorts of different animals. We're distinguishing there as well on the level of the insects. There are, right, the kosher, non-kosher animals, the fish, you know, all sorts of different levels. So... yeah, and so on and so forth. So there is that idea. Yeah.
I read an article, the author, his name escapes me at the moment, about Kashrut with Solomon theory, that the animals that are not kosher tend to be animals that are predators, and therefore it's one other layer of keeping us away from murderous.
Yeah. That's interesting.
You are to me. Theory.
Yes, that's one. And you have that in Kabbalah as well, and in Halakha, this idea that you can become tainted somehow by the non-kosher. So yeah,
the notion of the things that have claws are universally not
correct.
Kosher.
Yeah,
because claws are also.
But they're violent.
They're violent, right? That's
carnivorous. That is interesting. Then you have the example of the Chasida, which is kind, right? The stork, which is kind, right? Only to its own, but not kind to others. And so that also is excluded. There's the Rashi quote from the Midrash that says that. And so there are even more subtle examples of cruelty, which the Torah makes sure to differentiate as well. So in that context, Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes a number of Talmudic or Midrashic accounts which sort of go to this idea. So I'd like to read those with you and elaborate them as a way of sort of filling in sort of man's best friend or the same orbit kind of theory. So if you take a look at the sheet that you have here, source 14, Avot Rabbi Natan. Avot Rabbi Natan is a rabbinic expansion of Pirkei Avot, essentially. And so what you have here, it once occurred that the donkey of Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa was stolen by robbers who hid it in a courtyard, left it straw and barley and water, but it would not eat or drink. They said, why should we leave it, that it may die and stink up the courtyard? They stood up and opened the gate and sent it out. It wandered until it reached the home of Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. When it reached him, the son heard its voice. He said to his father, Father, that sounds like the voice of our animal. He said to him, my son, open the door, for it is dying of hunger. He stood and opened the door, left it straw and barley and water, and it ate and drank. The sages therefore said, just as the righteous of generations past were pious, so were their animals pious as they. And just a point of fact, why did it eat some and not others? Was it non-kosher water? Like the new chumrah of the week, non-kosher water. It has to have a hechsher.
No.
Yeah, give me a break.
Okay.
Right.
The question, knowing that.
No, but why? But why? What's the difference?
Why we not eat the?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was the water.
No, it's because it was.
Why the barley? Barley require.
Why do you not eat the barley?
Yeah, what's the difference? What does it require for it to be kosher? The barley. Right, okay, there's no separation of tithes. The truma and the maaser are necessary to be separated. And so what it's saying is that even if it's kosher in terms of what we think about, right, but it's not kosher in terms of the truma that needs to be separated, and it's an extremely severe prohibition to eat food that requires the separation of truma and not. In fact, if you eat it, the technical halacha is with proper warning and so on and so forth, if that warrants misa bidei shemayim, death by heavenly decree, it's exceedingly severe, more severe than the traditional or sort of default prohibition in the Torah. So this is big stuff. What?
No, seriously.
Where is that? That pasuk I think is in. I want to say it's in Parshat Emor, I believe. But we can just double check.
That doesn't extend to animals in terms of what you.
No. I'm just explaining.
I know.
That's just the point of it.
I'm saying there's no concept. There's no concept in that. Is there?
You just read it.
No.
No.
I'm saying.
No.
In terms of like
feeding.
Feeding. You feed your animals.
No.
Doesn't have to.
No. Where there's a prohibition in a strict halachic sense, where there's a prohibition against deriving benefit. So, for example, chametz on Pesach or basar b'chalav, meat and milk that are mixed together. So there already it's prohibited to feed it to the animals. But if it's in this case, it would not. There would not be. There's no strict prohibition in feeding it to your animals. So it wouldn't apply. No. Now, what is this Gemara? What is this Gemara driving at? I mean, or the Midrash, excuse me, or Chazal.
Didn't eat the barley because it wasn't.
It wasn't kosher. It wasn't. There wasn't.
That's a different point of view.
What?
I thought the donkey didn't eat.
Yeah.
Food that the robbers gave them because that would legitimize the theft.
Ah.
Oh.
Okay.
Interesting.
That's interesting. Okay. And that would explain the straw and the water, at least. Okay. But either way, this is a very from animal.
Yeah.
What?
Either way. So what, you know, what, I mean, what's this Chazal, I mean, is this, I mean, what are we meant to derive from this?
Well,
you know, should we, is this like a practical matter? Like we should, you know, if your pet is stolen by your, you know, like really, what's it, you know?
Well, the last statement, one of the possible implications of the last statement is this very prevalent notion that the environment is very influential.
Mm-hmm.
So just as, you know, so you could say an exaggeration is,
uh-huh,
even the animals of the frum are frum,
mm-hmm,
because the environment counts.
Mm-hmm.
Kayabar talks a lot about
mm-hmm
that. And I think... the big mystery of Sodom and Gomorrah,
mm-hmm,
Abraham's argument,
mm-hmm,
ultimately stop at 10,
right?
Because
mm-hmm
it's very unlikely, even if.
But the notion of environment is.
The notion, yeah, I
right
see that
might. Okay. Good. So Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes it, and he says, in this notion of animals keeping kosher or holding themselves to halakhic, strict halakhic standards, he says, part of what the Gemara is driving at is that the idea that the animal somehow, even symbolically, an extension of the master. If you just as the Devim, that's what it says, just as the righteous of generations past were pious, so were their animals as pious as they. He obviously wouldn't have said this for multiple reasons about their rocks, you know, or maybe even their goldfish. And going, you know, raising, going to that question for multiple reasons. But really, again, it's sort of what it's driving at is this idea that we really see the animals as an extension of the master, and it really goes to this thesis. Other examples as well, Gemara and Chulin, over here, in source 15. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair was once traveling. He stayed at an inn. They gave barley to his donkey, and again, predictably, this we know already, it would not eat. Okay, this case is pretty clear what the reason is, we'll see. They shelled it, but it did not eat. Said he to them, perhaps it is untied. Okay, they tied the barley, and lo and behold, it ate. He said, the poor beast attempts to perform the will of its creator, and you feed it untied food? Hey, this is. He stood and said to him, well, hold on, Rebbe, we have a Shiloh, we have a real question here. But did our master not teach us that animal feed is exempt from tithing? They're like learning the sunya, the technicalities, right? Said he to them, and what shall I do with this poor fool, i.e., the donkey, that is stringent on itself? Gemara. Okay. It's a machmir chamor, right? It's actually, by the way, it's a pun.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a pun on the term chamor, which you lose in the translation completely.
Why is it chamor from the same show?
What? So sometimes it's used sometimes if someone is too strict in a derogatory sense, they'll say, oh, it's the same thing. And so I think it has to do with the idea of, I don't know historically, I wonder if it has to do with the idea of stubbornness. I mean, often we associate the donkey with that sense of stubbornness. So I wonder if that's part of the connection.
Cool.
just a suggestion. But again, I mean, you know, and this is like, it's one thing, you know, it's like, he's more mocking than the Rosh Hashiva, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is really, this is unbelievable. But again, you see this idea, and here it's clear in the ties, but whatever the halakhic issue is, a super strict chamor, it's really this idea, again, that they're really, really from, and again, this idea that maybe it's as an extension of, you know, it's not the animal, you don't find a frum chamor that belongs to some bandit or even just a random person, right? It's right specifically the chamor of Rav Pinchas ben Yair, who is considered, this Gemara is about his piousness, his piety. He was the one, actually, the Mesilat Yesharim, which has 15 levels of achievement that are described in the Musar classic Mesilat Yesharim, are drawn from the list attributed to Rav Pinchas ben Yair, I believe in this Sugyan, this Gemara. So he is considered to be one of the pious people of the time of the Gemara, and so it's of course no coincidence that his donkey is equally, if not more, pious than his master. You find another one, and one final example, another midrash, Psikta Rabati. There was once a pious man who had a cow for plowing. After some time, the man became poor and sold the cow to a Gentile. A Gentile plowed with it for 6 weekdays. On the Shabbat, he took it out to plow, and it chafed, and the yoke did not want to work. He hit it, but it refused to budge. When he saw this, he went to the pious man and said, "Come take your cow for 6 days. I have worked with it. On the seventh, I have taken it out." And it refused to do any work at all, no matter how much I hit it. It refuses to budge. When he said this, the pious man understood why it did not do work, for it had been trained not to work on the Shabbat. So the pious man, and you go find the animal that knows, you know, that just, you know, keeps track, right?
Count.
Right, that's right. So counting, it's Hans, right? That's the famous Hans the horse. Anyone know about Hans the horse? That was the one that there was. I don't remember the name of the person who owned Hans the horse, but whoever it was, he used to go around the country, around the world, right? And it was this amazing thing. They figured out afterward how it knew to count.
Association of sounds.
I think it was one of two things. It was either, or maybe a combination, it was either that the pitch of voice was somehow subtly different, or there was some physical twitch that the animal picked up on. Because what we do is you go one, two, you count up to the answer. And then he would always start, you know, banging with its hooves whenever the owner got to the right answer. I think there was also some sort of physical twitch that that Hans the horse picked up on and started to. So this is it. So this is right. But you see from here, Hans the horse, right? We predate that by, you know, I don't know. Yeah, well over 1,000 years. Okay, we've got that too. So the horse is it. So is it the horse counts days till Shabbos? Right? What does that mean? Said the pious man, "Come and I will make it plow." When he reached it, he said in its ear, "Cow, cow. When you were in my keep, you would rest on the Shabbat. Now that my sins have caused my poverty, I have sold you to a non-Jew. Please stand and perform the will of it, your master." And immediately stood and sought to work. The Gentile said to the pious man, "I will not let you go until you tell me what you did and what you said in its ear. Maybe you would bewitched it." Right? The Jew is bewitching the cow. Said the pious man, "Such and such is what I said to him." When the Gentile heard this, he paled, he shook, and judged to himself, "If this animal that has no speech, intellect, or understanding recognizes its creator, I, whom God created in His image and gave intellect and understanding, shall I not recognize my creator?" Immediately converted and merited to study Torah, and was called Rabbi Yochanan, the son of a cow.
It's a very well-known rug. Many,
yes. You know, taken very seriously by adoring Talmidim throughout the globe. Yeah.
I've thought about an element of that in. I'm sorry, it's been a long day. You know the guy who brings the donkey to Bilam, mm-hmm. This donkey is able to recognize.
Donkey has eyesight and sees the angel.
And,
yeah.
And I thought that it was a little bit of a satire on the Jewish people. What happens immediately before Bilam episode of Tanakh? No. What's the context?
It's.
What, what, Jewish people do something particularly foolish. I forget what.
It's
many examples, but
it's Shlach Korach. I think Korach is
Right. So Korach, and here the donkey understands better than Korach that God has a way of doing things,
right?
So I
and that's an ironic example, because there it's not as an it's the opposite of its master. It's actually sort of the inverse example. That is interesting. Yeah, food for thought. Tithed food for thought. Properly tithed food for thought. Yes.
The donkey was created when the earth was created.
Yeah, according to the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, that's right. Yeah. Ben Ashmasho.
It's his purpose.
Right.
So where was all that donkey?
Yeah, 100%. What?
Where was the donkey all this time?
Where was the donkey all this time? Well, I take it as literally as you take some of these stories. But here, the donkey is not, or the animal, in this case, the cow rather, it's not only is it pious and does it observe Shabbos, but it inspires a conversion. And a rabbi is, right, the rabbi convert is named after the cow. I mean, these are from cows. There's no two ways about it. So this is all by way of this idea that sort of the animals are extensions of their master, and so they're taking on almost human-like characteristics. I don't believe for a moment that the Gemara means that the thrust or the intention of the Gemara is that animals are comparable to humanity. I don't think that that's the idea in the full sense. What I think what it means, though, is that they're an extension of us, and they reflect our characteristics in contradistinction to the animal of Bilam, which perhaps needed to be created during the 6 days of creation because it was the very polar opposite of its master, and it had eyes to see, and its master really did not. Here, they don't need to be created during the 6 days of creation because that's what it means to be the pet dog of, you know, of Rav Pinchas ben Yair, or whomever it may be. And we find other examples of this idea as well, that there are symbolic usages of an animal in which the animal almost takes on representative characteristics of a person, or represents the human being in a ritual process, in halacha. In particular, I'm thinking about the example of korbanos, of the sacrifices. What happens when I offer a korban? So first of all, you have this idea. This is developed explicitly by the Ramban, by Nachmanides, in a classic passage, in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tet of Sefer Vayikra. The Ramban elaborates the purpose of korbanot. He quotes the Rambam. The Rambam, fairly well known, the Rambam suggests, at least in one passage in his Moreh Nevuchim, that really korbanot are less than ideal. They're a concession to the frailty of humanity, at least at that point in history, that felt a need for some sort of concrete manifestation or physical way of connecting with the divine. They weren't fully weaned off of pagan practice, and so as part of that evolutionary process, so the Rambam suggests that that's why God gave us korbanos. The Ramban is highly critical of the Rambam's theory in his Moreh Nevuchim, and he offers an alternative. One of the theories that is offered by the Ramban is that essentially what we are declaring is we're making a pretty harsh statement about ourselves. You find echoes of this in the Yom Kippur liturgy and the Slichos, which is essentially that because of our sins against our master, against God, really, by rights, we have forfeited our very right to existence. Very harsh statement about ourselves. We've essentially rebelled against the will of the king time and time and time again, and therefore on some level, suggests the Ramban, somewhat harshly perhaps, the Ramban suggests that on some level, if we were following strict justice, you could make an argument that we've maybe, you know, extended our lease a little bit too long. And really we're in a very precarious situation. Now God, fortunately, does not judge us with mere din, but with rachamim, with mercy as well. And so for HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not take our life or doesn't demand anything overly harsh from us in terms of that punishment, but he does require us to offer a representative sacrifice. And so what we're saying, when a sinner brings a sin offering, according to the Ramban, the purpose of such a korban is essentially to say that I should be offering myself up to you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you're kind enough to let me off the hook for that. But what I do instead is I offer the animal instead, or as a representation of myself, please consider it as if I have offered myself before you. That's the Ramban suggests, is the idea of a korban. And so essentially what we're doing is we're replacing the human with the animal. And in fact, there's a particular practice that we perform in which we essentially exchange our identities, one could argue, and I think it actually is true, in which we essentially exchange our identity with the animal. Any suggestions what that would be? What does the owner of a korban need to do? So what's smicha? Right? So usually we say, we talk about smicha, we think about, you know, rabbinic ordination, right? But because Moshe laid his hands on Yehoshua. That's true. But the idea, and that was probably the same thing, smicha, the owner would lean. Now how much of the body weight would the owner lean?
I think a lot, right?
100%. Yeah, a lot. Fully. In other words, essentially the act of smicha wasn't just sort of, I would just kind of lean over like if someone gives a bracha to their children on Friday night, you put your hands over their head type of thing. No, this is a full body leaning. In other words, what one is required to do as part of the act of smicha, in fact, I don't think you fulfill the requirement if you don't do it in this way, is I have to lean my full entire body weight so that I'm supported essentially by the animal.
I mean, a lot of the animals that people sacrifice for like doves. No.
Oh, good. So this is true. This is interesting. I guess this is another question. This is for the yeah. This is for the larger animals, and it wouldn't apply, interestingly enough, for those, as well as a flower offering. This goes to Lem's question in terms of which animals are symbolized in this way. The smicha is performed specifically, but in the case of the larger animals, and so I think what's going on is really when I learned the sugyot in when I was learning zvachim in Menachot, all this. The sections in the Gemara that talk about the animal sacrifice and the flower sacrifice, etc. I really think this actually emerges as the sort of the simple understanding as to what smicha is all about. It's a full body leaning in which there's a transfer of identity from myself onto the animal, but then in turn is sacrifice. And it's as if I'm saying, either because of a penance, because of a sin, or even without the Ramban, if I'm just saying, I am symbolically giving myself up before you. I am, as it were, saying I'm wholly dedicated to you to the extent that I sacrifice myself, except we firmly reject human sacrifice and we offer a representative substitute instead. So again, we see this idea of animals, and not flower offerings, and not the doves or the pigeons, the birds either, interestingly enough, we don't find it. So maybe that goes to this discussion as well. It's interesting.
Especially relevant with the goats of Lazazel.
Sure.
The goat is specifically supposed to be taken for sins.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other one is sacrificed. Right. There, I think it's very, very
right, very graphic. And I think you could say that the Seirim there also, I think it works nicely. The way I understand the two goats, the one, because really they're identical goats that have opposite fates or destinies. One is La'azazel, and the other one goes literally inside the Kodesh HaKadashim. It's sprinkled with the Kohen Gadol all the way through what's going on. But really, I think it's representative. The twin is really us as individuals. And I think what it's really saying is that we are born the way that we are. The same person we are, depending on our choices, can go one way or can really go the other. And ultimately, it's for us to make that determination. So I think it's really, and again, it sounds like good drasha material. I think it's really rigorous. I think it's true, and it's also, I think that it's rooted in a rigorous reading of the sources as well, if you explore that topic. And so again, Azazel, I agree with Emily that it really confirms this idea that there's this representation, this symbolism. So this is all by way of suggesting that one sort of way of massaging or thinking about this issue is to say, of course there's a clear distinction between humanity and the animal kingdom, but because there is a kind of a sort of unique relationship, we see this notion that animals are extensions of their masters or symbolize humanity in halakhic rituals in ways that might not or would not be true in the case of the flower offering or maybe even the turtle dove and other kinds of animals that have a certain greater distance with mankind. So that's sort of the first idea, sort of an extension of Rabbi Soloveitchik's his line of thinking. That's one. There's another stance with regard to how to sort of grapple with this issue, and that's an approach really developed by Rav Kook. And in particular, Rav Kook's position in the context of vegetarianism. Rav Kook has, we've I think, mentioned it. I'm not going to elaborate at great depth, but Rav Kook has a fairly well-known passage, or really essay, that was published. It's called Chazon HaTzimchiyut VaHatzimchonut VaShalom, which is the vision of Tzimchonut, which is the Hebrew word, modern Hebrew word for vegetarianism, and peace and harmony, in which he outlines this idea that essentially, first of all, he stresses animal rights in a powerful kind of way. He says that it's an extension of natural morality to be concerned for the rights of, or not the rights. He wouldn't use the term rights, but he would say the life and the dignity, and to avoid the suffering of animals. And that's just simply an extension of natural morality, which is then confirmed by multiple sources in the Torah. That does not mean that it's aser teshech. That does not mean you can never use animals for legitimate or valuable purposes. But it does mean that certainly to cause wanton, unnecessary pain is against a core principle of the Torah. And beyond that, this is something we really need to be mindful of as religious believing Jews. That's Rav Kook's starting point. And then he develops the classic thesis that in the Messianic era, because an outgrowth of this idea, we will no longer offer animal sacrifices. He quotes the pasuk from Malachi, which we say at the end of Shmoneh Esrei, say ve'arva laHashem, it will be sweet for Hashem. He's talking about a description, say from Malachi, one of the Treasar, in the end of Nevi'im, in which he describes the Messianic era. Ve'arva laHashem, be sweet to Hashem, minchat Yehuda v'Yerushalayim v'mincha, offering of Judah and Jerusalem. And he understands mincha meaning not just a generic gift, but which specific category of korban constitutes the mincha. Right, the flower offering specifically. So what he suggests is that Malachi's vision for the Messianic era is that we will be offering minchat Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, only the korban mincha, not any of the animal offerings, and the rest of them we will be on a higher moral or ethical plane. Moreover, says Rav Kook, not only will we achieve a higher level of ethics, but the animals themselves will be more similar to humanity. Based on what narrative does he suggest that? What's the original example, classic example of animals acting as if they're human in the Torah? What?
Noah's Ark.
Which animal acts human in Noah's Ark? Earlier.
Oh,
yeah, the Nachash, right? The Nachash in Gan Eden, right? I mean, look at them. They're right. They're bantering back and forth. There's a dialogue here, and according to the Kabbalists, according to the Kabbalists and other sources as well, earlier, prior to some of those Kabbalistic sources, you find the notion that essentially the Messianic era will be a return to the state of Gan Eden. And so, as an outgrowth of that, Rav Kook suggests, based on Kabbalistic sources, that Yemos HaMashiach, not only will we have a higher ethical sensibility toward the animals, but also, and therefore not offer them, but also they themselves will somehow be a little bit different. And they may be walking, talking creatures in ways that we might seem to be something out of your worst, your worst. That's right.
And the predators still be predators?
Will the predators still be predators? Probably not, actually. Yeah, that's Yeshayahu. What? They're all going to be. That's right. We're all going to be herbivores. This is basically what it comes to. They'll be herbivores. We'll be vegetarians, and that's it. So this is what's very well known. And on the basis of this piece, some of Cook's outstanding students became vegetarians. One of his sons-in-law is a vegetarian, and others in his inner circle, his very close students, is known as the Nazir. One individual, Rav David Cohen, who was very close with him, studied Kabbalah, in particular with Rav Kook, or that aspect of Rav Kook's thought. There's this whole outgrowth of vegetarianism that emerges from Rav Kook's thinking on this issue, and yet, if you read the entire essay carefully, not only does Rav Kook not recommend in the here and now that we adopt vegetarianism, but he actually recommends against it.
But he didn't accept the Shabbat.
Good. He says one should not be a full-fledged vegetarian, he says. Why? But he said it would be wrong not to eat on Shabbat, for example, or one part. He says that he doesn't say asur, but he thinks it's wrong. He does say it's wrong. Why does he think it's wrong? In other words, Rav Kook's position, we often hear the jarring part, the remarkable part, the one half of it, but the other side, it's not always mentioned. And again, Rav Kook's own students gravitated, some of them at least gravitated, although others did not. So what's this other, but why? What, it's one thing to say it's not mandatory. Okay, but why would he insist? And not just because of the technicalities of the laws of Shabbat or Yom Tov or something like that, which would be a separate argument that you have to eat meat on Shabbat and Yom Tov as part of the celebration of the day, and so that's why. And that's not what he is suggesting. What's going on? So what Rav Kook essentially says, what it boils down to, is he says it would be ethically wrongheaded or backward, historically backward, to jump now into vegetarianism. He says, right now, we have some pretty serious issues in terms of human rights. Now, this is before World War II. Rav Kook passes in 1935. But he did live through World War I. And that was, that was considered at the time the war to end all wars. I mean, it's just that we think of World War II, and it's sort of often, especially in the Jewish consciousness, often eclipses World War I. But that's not what anyone who survived World War I was thinking. That much is pretty clear. And so Rav Kook sees what violence really looks like in the human condition, and he says we've got a pretty long way to go here in the 20th century, and if we start jumping into this kind of ethical behavior with regard to the animal kingdom before we've made serious strides with regard to humanity, he says, in his opinion, that would be taking the wrong steps at the wrong time. And that's a suggestion. Rav Kook, remember, thinks about things from an evolutionary perspective. His whole theory of history is actually the inverse in certain ways of Yiridat HaDorot. It's true that certain individuals have declined, but as a human civilization, actually, Rav Kook has a very idealistic, optimistic perspective. We're constantly getting to, but if we're going to go backward, if we're going to skip steps, that is problematic for this entire evolutionary process. And so Rav Kook actually ends up opposing vegetarianism now and says we've got to wait until, once we've got the human rights issues worked out, well then in the Messianic era we'll be ready to come to animals. And there are some who have critiqued certain organizations, animal rights organizations, for maybe prioritizing certain aspects of that agenda over other aspects and perhaps recommending that they be sort of recalibrated. Now, others might push back and say, we don't oppose those other projects. This just happens to be our focus, so we can kind of debate this issue. But be that as it may, that's Rav Kook's perspective. What I think is interesting for our conversation is Rav Kook is sort of saying, you know what? There's a lot of legitimacy to all of this, and maybe we need to rethink, or traditionally we have always thought of animals as having a soul and needing to be treated with a certain level of dignity, certainly not any, again, Rav Kook is a traditional Jewish thinker, does not equate for a moment, but a soul, a lower level soul, but a soul nonetheless, Rav Kook says, a certain kind of dignity, we need to treat them with a certain kind of respect. However, we should be careful lest we get ahead of ourselves. And if we go too far, too fast, too soon, that actually is inconsistent, even hypocritical maybe. And therefore should be avoided. Now I'm saying this in an intentionally,
could you say,
somewhat provocative way, not totally, but a little bit.
Couldn't one say though?
Yeah, stimulate
adopting a vegetarian lifestyle ethic would lead one to live that life.
Right. Yeah. 100%.
Perhaps lead others.
And that's perhaps what his students thought about this as well. He doesn't address it. There's a clear counter-argument here. And it is interesting. You know, it's interesting if you think about, for example, someone who's embracing Judaism. Think about the process of a Baal Tshuva. So let's say you had a friend who is now just learning about Judaism and observant Judaism for the first time. And they were asking for advice, or you were speaking with them, and they were suggesting that they adopted certain stringencies with regard to a matter of halacha, but hadn't yet fully accepted, let's say, Shabbat or Kashrut or whatever it may be. what would your response be?
Jumping the gun.
So you would say jumping the gun. It might I mean, I'm, this is too. Probably my example is too broad. It probably depends on the nature of the stringency.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to give an example. If it's like, you know, you're doing kashrut but not Shabbat, that's one thing. If you're doing, if you're, you know, taking on some exotic, you know, chumrah that's, you know, way out there, that seems to be well outside the mainstream, you know, you insist on tying red strings around everything, but you're not keeping Shabbat, you know, so that already might, that might be a different kind of scenario. But
skipping is just being a pants, and you're like skipping steps.
Right. But let's say this for me is part of my growth process, and you're, I'm like, this is what I'm, this speaks to me, and I'm really, this is really, you know, I'm not, I think I should be keeping Shabbat. I'm just not there yet. You know, I'm just one step at a time. I'm just learning about this, and I'm growing. This is not how I live my life. And there's just this other thing I happen to come across, and there's just something about my journey and this practice that really speaks to me right here, right now. One more time? I'm giving a scenario. I'm saying, is it somewhat analogous? You know, this question in Rav Kook's case, you know, is Rav Kook's case analogous to, you know, the exotic chumrah, which is way out there, or is it analogous to the, yes, it's not a totally even kind of process, but
maybe it's analogous to, isn't there a concept with a ger, which they don't keep Shabbat, until, like, there's something they,
yeah,
they well, can the keep Gemara, Shabbat, but the they've got to do some kind of malacha, like they can't do full.
Yeah, that's the classic story about, yeah, the Gemara says, the Goshe Shabbat Chayav Mita. It's the classic story about the guy who was whatever was carrying outside the Erev, and the guy or was not carrying, the guy says, what do you mean, I thought you're not keeping you know, you didn't convert, yeah. so the guy who still hadn't converted says, you hold from that Erev. Is that yeah,
maybe it's a similar concept in terms of Rav Kook saying, mm-hmm, we're not there yet, mm-hmm, so therefore don't go fully observe this vegetarianism.
Right. Maybe. Just interesting. It could be. That's a possibility.
I wonder what a psychological perspective of this is. In the sense that,
right, yeah,
if people start with things that are most meaningful to them,
right,
rather than in some prescribed path,
yeah,
that might be a way of making the whole endeavor more meaningful.
More palatable.
Right. You know, start, what don't we say in teaching? Start where the student is.
Right.
And sometimes the student is like, not so much.
Right.
But
Never with teenagers.
Yeah, right.
Other students, yeah.
I don't know, so I wonder what a psychologist would say.
Interesting.
What?
Good. 100%. Good. So running low on time, I just want to mention because we're wrapping up for this section. But one other piece, and with this really conclude, so we mentioned two perspectives. So Rav Meir Soloveitchik says different but same orbit, etc. Rav Kook says yes, we should learn a lot about from these findings, but let's not skip steps. That's Rav Kook's approach. Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav himself, actually has a whole book about this, a very difficult book, posthumously published, called The Emergence of Ethical Man. And he discusses exactly this dichotomy, and it's similar to Lonely Man of Faith in certain respects. You know, man as part of nature, man apart from nature, and he really reflects on this. But I think part of what he's suggesting here and elsewhere is that essentially, what's the resolution to this problem? How do we determine as individuals whether we are animalistic beasts of the jungle or refined heavenly celestial beings? How do we resolve that for ourselves? And what the Rav essentially says here and elsewhere as well, he elaborates, is that really this is the purpose of the halachic discipline. This is really an essential tenet to a central tenet to what halacha is all about. When we avoid eating certain foods, forget the chosenness that symbolizes Jews and Gentiles, etc., but we're instilling within ourselves the ability to conquer the animalistic desire that lies dormant within, and that really was the underlying sin of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden, which is not to discipline themselves. That one commandment, they weren't able to overcome their aesthetic sensibility. and their sort of the apple or whatever the fruit was capturing their eye, and really having that allure to them. When we observe all the sexual ethic of the halacha is about sort of rising over that aspect and really purifying it and allowing us to rise up as really more than just animalistic beasts that really give in to craven desires and so on and so forth. That's really what the world of halacha, with the halachic discipline and lifestyle and ethic, is really meant to cultivate and to teach us, and really the way it's supposed to craft our humanity. And it's very interesting in this respect. The Rav doesn't quote this, but I'll mention it as well. The Aruch HaShulchan, one of the classic 19th century codifiers, not the Shulchan Aruch, the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, in his classic halachic work, he suggests that this is the transition from Pesach to Shavuot. His suggestion essentially is, he says, on Pesach, the second day of Passover, bring the Omer. He's accounting of the Omer. And the Omer consists of barley. Shavuot, 50 days later, when we're finally prepared to receive the Torah, so there we bring the Shtei Halachem, which is wheat. It says in Halacha, if you look in the Gemara, it's very clear that barley is considered to be animal food, animal feed, and the wheat is considered to be fit for human consumption. And so essentially what we're doing, says the Aruch HaShulchan, is this transition of the period of Sfirat HaOmer, what we're really doing throughout that course, the course of that period of time, is essentially we're rising through the discipline of the Torah and of the halachic discipline, we're rising from the level of animal to ultimately the level of human beings. And I would just suggest, in closing as well, that this is perhaps also part of the transition of this time, of this week, in particular, the Aseret Yimei Tshuva from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, perhaps, just a thought. On Rosh Hashanah, what instrument do we use in particular? The shofar. The shofar is identified as also a symbol, is another example of the physical animal, an extension of the animal, being used as a symbol, not of the human being, perhaps of the human being, but we utilize it. And essentially what we say, the Yerushalmi actually says, we're squealing before you like animals. There's almost this bestial, primal cry through the shofar. And that's why it's been suggested the shofar has to physically resemble its shape when it was on the animal. If you reshape it, you recast it too dramatically, it no longer is clear that it comes from, that it derives from the animal, and therefore it's disqualified for use. So Rosh Hashanah, really, there's a sense of this primal cry in which we associate with animals, this sort of desperation on the Yom HaDin. And then, over the course of the week, and then culminating in Yom Kippur, of course, Yom Kippur, to whom or to what are we compared? The other end of the spectrum. We're elevated to be on the level of the angels, right? We're not wearing full-fledged shoes. We feed together, whether it's the symbolism of the kittel and the inuyim, the afflictions that we adopt upon ourselves, the piyutim that we recite over the course of Yom Kippur. There are constant references to the idea that we are really becoming angelic. So is it possible that part of the transition between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, through our practices over the course of Aseret Yemei Tshuva, through the extra prayers, through the penitence, through the tzedakah and so on and so forth, essentially what we're marking is a parallel transition from this primal, instinctual, desperate, bestial cry of the shofar to ultimately be elevated through that discipline and through those practices to the level, really, of those celestial beings, and to ultimately achieve that potential that lies dormant within the human being, who prior to that was really caught in this tension, in the thicket, as it were, between these two aspects that are pulling at us. So these are some just food for thought, talking back to earlier discussion, but really perhaps different perspectives how to resolve this tension, and perhaps a perspective this time of the year in particular. So I thank all of you. I'll just mention our next series will start, it's going to be a little bit of time. So we're going to pick up pretty much, I think, after the Chagim. That's the next time that we're going to meet. Next Wednesday night is, I think, it's 3 weeks. Because we've got Sukkot, we've got the beginning of Sukkot, then we've got the end of Sukkot, and then the final week. So in 3 weeks, God willing, we'll pick up. We're probably going to look at a totally different topic, unrelated. Probably 2-3 weeks on the topic of punishment in Jewish philosophy why do we punish? What is the motivation for punishment? Is there a notion of retribution? Is it just so that we can deter others or that individual from sinning? Is there a notion of rehabilitating the sinner? Rehabilitation, which is all the rage now in terms of the penal code in America and elsewhere. Why do we punish? How do we punish? And sort of what's the underlying theory? And we'll look at both Jewish and also some Western sources about that. So that's going to be our next topic, and we'll go from there.
But you can go to visit the Eastern.